When we entered Bobrusk, some of its buildings were ablaze and others lay in ruins. To Bobrusk led the road to revenge. With difficulty, our car finds its way amid scorched and distorted German tanks and self-propelled guns. Men are walking over German corpses. Corpses, hundreds and thousands of them, pave the road, lie in ditches, under the pines, in the green barley. In some places, vehicles have to drive over corpses, so densely they lie upon the ground. People are busy all the time burying them, but there are so many that this work cannot be done in just one day. And the day is exhaustingly still, hot, and people walk and drive pressing handkerchiefs to their noses. A cauldron of death was boiling here, where the revenge was carried out, a ruthless, terrible revenge over those who hadn't surrendered their arms and tried to break out to the west. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to describe the entire Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, in Canada, a free, independent, sovereign country. And I'm joined today by my stalwart assistant, Ragnar the Magnificent, who's already made me have to start this podcast recording over again. This episode is number 78, and we're focusing on Operation Bagration, the major Soviet offensive against the German forces in Belorussia in June to July 1944. Last episode, author Craig Luther helped us set the stage for this fourth mighty blow against Nazi Germany. As he described, the Eastern Front in June 1944 once again featured a huge German salient, a pronounced bulge in the lines to the east, in this case, 428 miles, or 690 kilometers long. The German officers called this the Belorussian Balcony, as on the map it looked like it was overhanging the Red Army's positions to the south. That's because, over the spring of 1944, the Red Army had retaken virtually all of Ukraine from east to west. And to the north, they had also relieved the siege of Leningrad after almost 900 days, or close to 3 years. Later in 1944, Stalin would recount 10 blows the Red Army struck to drive out the Nazi invaders. Up to June 1944, these were the Dnipro-Carpathian Offensive from Christmas Eve 1943 to 17 April 1944, the reconquest of Red Bank or Western Ukraine from the Great River in the middle of the country almost to its pre-war western border. This was described in episode 68 of this very podcast. Then came the Leningrad-Novgorod Offensive of January to March, which liberated or recaptured Leningrad, as described in episode 66 of this podcast. I use the word liberated with some qualms. I don't know if you can describe as liberation anything the Red Army did, but at any rate. The next mighty blow was the Odessa Offensive from 26 March to 14 April 1944, which drove the Nazis from the coast of the Black Sea, from the mouth of the Dnipro, and also from the Crimean Peninsula, all the way to Odessa and beyond to the Romanian border. The fourth mighty blow was the Vyborg-Petrozavodsk offensive, which began in early June against the Finns, north and west of Leningrad. More on that in a minute. And that brings us to the fifth mighty blow and the subject of this episode, Operation Bagration, the reconquest of Byelorussia, now called Belarus, that great salient that Craig Luther described as the Belarusian balcony last episode. I've described in this podcast a number of salients, and they are particularly vulnerable locations for the occupiers. This kind of bulge gives the enemy a chance to attack from three sides or more. At the same time, a salient stretches the defender's defensive lines out along a longer front, in this case close to 700 kilometers long. It's not hard to understand why German generals and field marshals had advocated withdrawing from salients on the Eastern Front and elsewhere. Some that come to mind include Demyansk, Rzhev, and yes, Kursk. Hitler had refused each time, at least for a while, resulting in great losses. On the other hand, when he did relent at Rzhev in 1943, that resulted in freeing up 20 divisions to move south for Operation Zitadel, or Citadel, in the summer of 1943, that huge attack on the Kursk salient, as described in episodes 51 to 54. But by the first half of 1944, several realities on the Eastern Front are painfully obvious. First, the German position is untenable. As mentioned before, the Germans have less than half the resources on the Eastern Front in men and materiel compared to the Red Army. They're also shrinking, unable to replace losses in men and materiel, while the Soviets are increasing as their factories, which they moved east in 1944, have ramped up to full production. By 1944 and even before, there was an increasing rift between the German general staff and their supreme leader and idol, Adolf Hitler, as the generals asked for strategic withdrawals all along the front to strengthen and shorten the lines and take up more defensible positions. Hitler ordered time and again to hold their positions. No retreat, no surrender. Hitler also ordered several cities to become fortresses, or in German, Festerplätze. The garrisons there were to hold out against all enemy attacks, no matter what, which typically meant a death sentence. And then, in June 1944, there's another major factor, the war on the Western Front, which means it's time for, you guessed it, what else is happening in the war? Let's focus on early June 1944. 5th June, after a one-day delay for weather, Operation Overlord begins across the English Channel. 1,000 British bombers drop 5,000 tons of bombs on German emplacements in Normandy, France. The next day, 6th June, D-Day. 155,000 troops from the US, UK, and Canada storm the beaches of Normandy, codenamed Gold, Juno, Omaha, Sword, and Utah. The Canadians penetrate the farthest of the Allies, but the overall impact is that they break through the Nazi so-called Atlantic Wall. At last, the second front that Stalin had been badgering the Allies for is opened up, even though there already had been a second front in Italy. But I digress. 9th June, the Red Army launches the Vyborg-Petrozavodsk offensive. After sham negotiations on the part of the Soviets, the Red Army launched an attack on Finnish forces to end the continuation war. First, the Leningrad Front brought 19 divisions plus two division-strength fortified regions, as well as two more tank brigades and 14 regiments of tank and assault guns to the Karelian Isthmus, that strip of land between Lake Ladoga and the Gulf of Finland. With all these forces in this narrow strip of land, there were 120 Red Army artillery pieces, guns, howitzers, rocket launchers, on average, per kilometer. Just at the town of Velkiasari, now called Beloostrov, there were 220 artillery pieces and Katyusha rocket launchers. On 9th June, 1,600 warplanes from the 13th Air Army hit Finnish positions at Velkiasari, while the artillery and the Baltic Fleet shelled their positions for 10 hours. The next day, the 30th Guard Corps spearheaded a ground assault on the town, scattering the defenders. The Finns resisted with German-supplied Panzerfausts and Panzerschrecks, portable, single-man-operated anti-tank weapons, but they were overwhelmed by sheer numbers. The Red Army captured the city of Vyborg, now on the Russian side of the border, by 20th June. That same day, the Red Army's Karelian Front attacked on the eastern side of Lake Ladoga, the area called White Karelia. They reached the city of Olenets about halfway up the shore of the lake on 25th June, but they had trouble getting farther in the rough, marshy, and heavily forested terrain. The next day, 21st June, the German 303rd Assault Gun Brigade, which was only at half strength at this point, plus the 122nd Infantry Division, arrived to help the Finns. But that very day, Stavka, the Soviet High Command, ordered an attack closer to the western shore of Lake Ladoga to surround the Finnish defenders. The Finns asked for peace terms, and the Soviets responded by demanding unconditional surrender. Understandably, the Finns rejected this, so the Red Army kept coming. But slowly, despite having a nearly 2-to-1 advantage in numbers of soldiers, a 5-to-1 advantage in guns, and a 7-to-1 advantage in tanks and planes. Moreover, the Finns' weapons were mostly obsolete, and very few in number. By 12 July, after having failed to break through the VKT defensive line between Vyborg Bay and the Vuoksi River, Stavka decided to withdraw some forces from the area so they could use them against Germany farther south. On 15 July, the Red Army was ordered to go to a defensive posture in Karelia, with armored units transferred for the Narva offensive in Estonia and Operation Bagration in Belorussia. Hardly a glorious victory for the Soviets, the continuation war did not get much mention at all in later Soviet or Russian histories. But Stalin did consider it one of the 10 blows of 1944. Besides forcing a German ally, albeit a reluctant one, out of the war, it did secure all of Lake Ladoga for the USSR and reopened the original route of the Kirov Railway from Murmansk to Leningrad and the White Sea-Baltic Canal also to Leningrad, vital supply lines for Lend-Lease. So let's focus on the big event on the Eastern Front in June 1944. I mentioned the Belorussian Balcony, that great salient in Belorussia. See map 2 on the webpage for this episode. That sector was mostly held by Army Group Center in 1944, commanded by Field Marshal Ernst Busch. So it would seem to be the next logical target for the Red Army. But the German High Command, the OKH, expected the next Soviet offensive to be against Army Group North Ukraine, to the south of the Balcony. So they transferred a third of Army Group Center's artillery, half its tank destroyers, and 88% of its tanks to Army Group North Ukraine, as well as the entire reserve on the Eastern Front, 18 panzer and mechanized divisions. On 22nd June, Army Group Center had 580 tanks, tank destroyers, and assault guns, and 143 soldiers per kilometer of the front line strung out along this 700-kilometer salient. And as I said, Hitler hated the idea of withdrawing. He accused any general or field marshal or officer of any kind who suggested strategic withdrawal, let alone retreat, as defeatist and traitorous. He ordered the Wehrmacht not to give up any more territory, whilst they had given up a lot. Hitler also declared certain cities as Festerplätze, as I mentioned, fortified towns where German garrisons would fight to the death. In Army Group Center's sector, these were Vitebsk, Orsha, Moglev, Bernovichi, Minsk, Bobruisk, Slutsk, and Vilnius. I mention these because they're going to be scenes of extremely bloody destruction. According to Antony Beevor, author of The Second World War, quote, commanders realized that the only way to save their formations was to falsify situation reports and war diary entries to justify withdrawals. End quote. With the presence of powerful enemy forces in northwestern Ukraine, such as around Lviv and in the Baltic areas, Belorussia made the most sense to the Stavka as a place to attack. The Soviets were also getting really good at Maskirovka, or the War of Deception. They had 4 tank armies in the Lviv-Peremyshl area, which is now in northwestern Ukraine and southeastern Poland. Now, these 4 tank armies were facing Army Group North Ukraine, so they drew the German forces down toward them, as I described above. These forces, these units, would become even more important later, in about a month, and we'll describe that in a future episode. For Operation Bagration, the attack on the Belarusian balcony, the Red Army assigned four fronts or army groups. The 1st Baltic Front, commanded by General Lieutenant Bagramian, included the 4th Shock Army, the 6th Guards Army — the term Guards was given to a unit that had achieved something significant — the 43rd Army, and the 3rd Air Army. Next was the 1st Belarusian Front, commanded by Marshal Konstantin Rokossovsky, including the 3rd, 33rd, 47th, 61st, and 69th Armies, the 3rd and 5th Shock Armies, the 8th Guards Army, the 1st and 2nd Guards Tank Armies, the 16th and 18th Air Armies, the 4th Artillery Corps, and the 1st Polish Army. This was a force supposedly communist, supported and controlled by Moscow, and not at all loyal to the Polish government in exile in London. So that's the 1st Belarusian Front. Then there's the 2nd Belarusian Front, commanded by, at this point, Georgi Zakharov. It includes the 19th, 49th, 50th, 65th, and 70th Armies, the 2nd Shock Army, the 5th Guards Tank Army, commanded by Pavel Rotmistrov, who had performed so significantly at Kursk a year earlier, and the 4th Air Army. Finally, the 3rd Belarusian Front under Colonel General Ivan Chernyakhovsky. It comprised the 5th and 31st Armies, the 11th Guards Army, and the 1st Air Army. The Polish Home Army would also play a role, but more on that later. In total, 1.6 million combat and support personnel, over 32,000 artillery pieces and mortars, 5,818 tanks and assault guns, and 7,799 aircraft. These faced fewer than 500,000 German combat soldiers, fewer than 500 operational tanks, total 580 as described, but not all of them were rolling. They were used for spare parts, basically, plus 600 flyable aircraft. Stalin set the date for the assault as 22nd June. Now, the Western Allies, that is, the Americans, Brits, and Canadians, would have liked the major Red Army assault to coincide with D-Day, originally the 5th of June. But Stalin had other ideas. First, the Normandy invasion would prompt the Germans to transfer divisions west from the Eastern Front, thus weakening the forces that the Red Army would have to face. But also, 22nd June was, and you know this, the 3rd anniversary of the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, Nazi Germany's initial attack on the USSR. So the symbolism was irresistible. First phase. Operation Bagration started with partisan attacks in German-occupied areas in Belarusia, starting on the night of the 19th to 20th June, all along that long front line. The next night, 20 to 21st June, the Soviets commenced air raids on German communication lines and probing attacks on the front positions. This was all part of the deception campaign Maskarovka, a double bluff to confirm the Germans' idea that the main attack would be to the south. After Maskarovka, the next step in the Soviet strategy was deep battle, breaking through the forward defenses, then pouring reserves through the breaks to encircle and destroy the enemy's operational depth, its reserves, and its supplies. Quote, on 22nd June, the 3rd anniversary of the beginning of the war with the Soviet Union, the enemy opened their summer offensive with attacks against the front of Army Group Center. In the 2nd Army area of operations, they had the character of reconnaissance attacks. In the 4th Army area of operations, they were assessed as pre-attacks to gain assault departure positions. In the 9th Army area of operations, it remained quiet on this day. On the other hand, the enemy began the real attack against the 3rd Panzer Army with the main effort against the 6th Army Corps southeast of Vitebsk and, surprisingly, also northwest of the city in the 9th Army Corps area of operations, between Sirotino and the left boundary of the army group. The major surprise to the German leadership, because the previous enemy picture did not indicate such an enemy concentration. End quote. From Anthony Tucker Jones, Stalin's Revenge, Operation Bagration and the Annihilation of Army Group Center. On the 23rd of June, the Soviets began their classic massive artillery barrage. This one was different, though, in scale and style. For the first time, they used a double rolling barrage. One group of artillery fired deeper or farther with each volley, driving the German forces from their forward defensive positions to secondary or tertiary lines. Now, the Germans were used to this. As soon as the barrage was over, they would return to the forward positions. But a second group of Red Army artillery would already be bombarding those lines again, thus trapping the Germans. According to Anthony Tucker Jones again, for the Germans, the density of the Soviet barrage was truly shocking. The four Soviet fronts brought to bear 24,000 guns and mortars along the 428-mile, 690-kilometer line. Up to 90% of the artillery was deployed on the breakthrough sectors, which only represented 10 to 20% of the overall width of the fronts themselves. End quote. All along the front, the Red Army artillery bombarded for 15 minutes to a depth of 3 kilometers, then paused and directed their fire at individual identified targets like artillery positions and weapons depots. Then the Sturmovik ground attack planes moved in, followed by the infantry to seize tactical positions, ready for the next attack. At some point, somewhere along the line, the German defenses would have to break. And they did. By midday on the 24th of June, the 252nd Infantry Division was falling back near Vitebsk, and the 1st Baltic Front crossed the western Dvina or Daugava River. Other units approached Vitebsk from the west, east, and south. Once again from Stalin's Revenge, quote, around midday on the 24th, General Armin Scheiderbauer and his comrades of the 252nd Infantry withdrew behind the Vitebsk-Polotsk railway line. He and Generalleutnant Vincenz Müller had great difficulty in preventing the men from jumping onto a goods train waiting at Lovcho station about to set off for Polotsk. The train had got no more than 100 meters when it was blasted by Soviet troops. End quote. And later, quote, at 13:12 hours on the 25th, Corps General der Infanterie Friedrich Gollwitzer signaled, quote, situation has changed. Completely encircled by reinforcing enemy. 4th Luftwaffe Field Division exists no longer. 246th Infantry Division and 6th Luftwaffe Field Division in heavy combat on several fronts. Various penetrations into the city of Vitebsk, end quote. Ominously, at 1500, Gollwitzer's HQ signaled, quote, situation at its climax, end quote. Field Marshal Busch informed the High Command that the situation was dire and they could not restore the line. The Soviets had a 3-to-1 advantage in manpower, 10-to-1 in tanks, and 8-to-1 in mortars and guns. But the OKH would not send reinforcements because they still feared an imminent attack on Army Group North Ukraine. And of course, Hitler refused to abandon Vitebsk, one of his fortress cities. South of Vitebsk, the same situation was playing out around Orsha and south of there, Mogilev, two more Festerplatze, or fortified cities. At the latter, the 27th Fusilier Regiment had dug 5 successive defensive ditches, which they would soon need. They managed to hold off the Red Army for one day, but had to retreat on the night of the 24th, breaking Hitler's order not to retreat. Even so, most of them were killed or captured. Of the 8,000 men of the garrison, only 3,000 made it farther west to Minsk. Now, let's take a look at the biggest Red Army front of Operation Bagration, commanded by our friend Konstantin Rocky Rokossovsky, right after this short break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to episode 78 of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of World War II. We're going to look at the largest Red Army front, or group of armies, taking part in Operation Bagration in June 1944. This was the first Belarusian front, commanded by Konstantin Rokossovsky. Their first objective was the city of Babrusk, south of Mogilev, and that is west of Smolensk, east of Minsk. Babrusk was held by the vaunted German 9th Army, which would later feature prominently in the final defense of Berlin. See episode 70 with podcaster David Sumner of Europe at War, and episodes 73 and 74, my discussions about the end of the war with author Anthony Tucker Jones, after you finish listening to this episode. Rokossovsky's 1st Belarusian Front attacked Babrusk from the south with five armies, plus two tank corps, a cavalry corps, and the Dnieper Combat Flotilla. Swampy ground slowed the Red Armies until 24th June, when they penetrated 6 miles or 10 kilometers. Meanwhile, the 1st Guards Tank Corps on the left side advanced 20 kilometers or 12 miles, and by the 25th was only 10 kilometers from the city. General Jourdan of the German 9th Army sent 71 Panzer Mark IVs to try to hold the Red Army back, but the Panzer Mark IVs were no match for the Soviet T-34. The Red 65th Army broke through in the south, and Rokossovsky put into operation the deep battle strategy, sending in the 1st Guards Tank Corps through the breach. The Panzers retreated south, but ran into more Soviet forces near the town of Slobodka. All along the line, the Red Army was advancing, and the Germans were dying. Babrusk was in Soviet hands by the 25th of June, Mogilev by the evening of the 27th. New Panther and Tiger tanks began arriving in Minsk, capital of Belarusia, by the 26th of June, and counterattacked along the Moscow-Minsk highway. While they inflicted casualties and knocked out many Soviet tanks, their effort was futile. Red Army surrounded city after city. They encircled a large German group east of the city of Babrusk by June 27. That morning, 526 planes of the 16th Air Army dropped 12,000 bombs on them in less than an hour. Again, to quote Anthony Tucker Jones, "In desperation, the Germans scattered under this air assault. Soldiers fled in panic, and panzers and trucks swerved off the roads in a desperate bid to escape the bombs, only to get stuck in the mud. Those men trying to swim the Berezina River were gunned down by the Soviets advancing along the western banks." Quote, "The Nazis ran out of the forests, rushed around the clearings. Many attempted to swim across the Berezina, but even this did not save them," noted Rokossovsky. "Soon, the bombed area became an enormous cemetery, scattered with bodies and equipment destroyed by the bombing." End quote. Now to go back to Antony Beevor's The Second World War. In the forests, the remnants of German formations pushed westwards to escape. They were short of water, and many soldiers became dehydrated in the heat. all suffered from intense stress through fear of ambush by partisans or capture by the Red Army. Bombers and artillery harrying the withdrawal brought down trees and sprayed them with wood splinters. The severity and ubiquity of the fighting was such that no fewer than 7 German generals from Army Group Center were killed in action. End quote. The last units resisting in Babrusk surrendered by 30th June, including generals and other senior officers. Soviet war correspondent Vasily Grossman was with the 1st Belorussian Front and reported this. When we entered Babrusk, some of the buildings in it were ablaze and others lay in ruins. To Babrusk led the road to revenge. With difficulty, our car finds its way amid scorched and distorted German tanks and self-propelled guns. Men are walking over German corpses. Corpses, hundreds and thousands of them, pave the road, lie in ditches, under the pines, in the green barley. In some places, vehicles have to drive over corpses, so densely they lie upon the ground. People are busy all the time burying them, but there are so many that this work cannot be done in just one day. And the day is exhaustingly hot, still, and people walk and drive, pressing handkerchiefs to their noses. A cauldron of death was boiling here, where the revenge was carried out. A ruthless, terrible revenge over those who hadn't surrendered their arms and tried to break out to the West. End quote. Revenge was heavy on the minds of the Germans, too. Two divisional commanders, Generalleutnants Karl Zutever and Ernst Philipp, committed suicide to escape this revenge. Why? Another unit had this to think about, and I think it's instructive. Quote, the longer-serving members of the 35th Infantry Division cannot have relished the prospect of capture, as the division had a very disreputable past. It was the only Wehrmacht division to have taken a significant role in the Holocaust in the Soviet Union. In the autumn and winter of 1941-42, it had assisted German security forces in liquidating some 10,000 Belorussian Jews. End quote. By the end of June, it was obvious to even Hitler and the OKH, the high command, that the situation in Belorussia was the main event of the Soviet summer offensive. The Red Army had taken all the forward defenses and was now closing on Minsk, the Belorussian capital. On 29 June, the Stavka clarified its new priorities. The 1st and 3rd Belorussian Fronts would concentrate on liberating or recapturing Minsk, with the 2nd Belorussian and 1st Baltic Fronts preventing the remaining Germans in Belorussia from counterattacking or even forming new tenable defenses. Keep them on the run, in other words. Minsk was another city that Hitler had deemed a Festerplatz, fortified and to be held no matter what. So, on 30th June, the Germans reorganized what they had left to block the Red Army in front of Minsk, form defenses west of the Berezina River, and hold the remaining fortress cities west of Minsk. The 4th Panzer Army from Army Group North Ukraine would take over defense of Brest-Litovsk in the south of the country. By the 1st of July, the Minsk garrison consisted of 1,800 combat soldiers plus 12,000 support staff. At this point, I think support are more of a drain than support. But anyway, there were also 8,000 wounded who would have to be left behind in a retreat and 15,000 unarmed personnel. The officers in charge began evacuating non-combat personnel by train on the 1st of July and mined bridges for demolition. However, Belorussian partisans moved quickly to prevent this. Rokossovsky's assault began at 0200 on 3rd July when the 2nd Guards Tank Corps entered the southern outskirts of the city. Meanwhile, Rotmistrov's 5th Guards Tank Army of Kursk fame cut off the retreat to the northwest. Then more Red Army units implemented the deep operation strategy in the form of the 11th Guards Army and the 31st Army. By that evening, still the 3rd of July, the Belorussian capital was firmly in Red Army command. Quote, the people danced in the streets of rubble, tears in their eyes as they welcomed the Red Army with flowers. The destruction was terrible, as Zhukov lamented. The capital of Belorussia was barely recognizable. He wrote, "I had commanded the regiment there for 7 years and knew well every street and all the main buildings, bridges, parks, stadiums, and theaters. Now everything was in ruins. Where whole apartment buildings had stood, there was nothing but heaps of rubble. The people of Minsk were a pitiful sight, exhausted and haggard, many of them in tears." End quote. Minsk had been the main objective of Operation Bagration. It was an important transportation hub, and the Germans knew that its loss was an irreparable harm to their fantasy of victory on the Eastern Front. There were still significant German units in Belorussia, west of the Berezina River and Minsk, but they had only one chance for survival to fight another day. Retreat. By 5th July, the Red Army had advanced 100 kilometers or over 60 miles west from the 22nd of June. The Germans were short on fuel and ammunition, and the Luftwaffe was all but non-existent. Once mechanized units were now infantry, marching on foot. The 12th and 27th Corps were trapped together in one pocket. They decided to try to break out, leaving behind 5,000 wounded with a letter begging for mercy. Just before midnight on 5th July, they struck out westward, southwest of Minsk in small groups, thinking they'd have a better chance of escaping the Red Army. One group of about 1,000 attacked a Soviet unit and was left with only 100 men at the end. By the time they reached Vilnius, they were down to 30. By 9th July, the largest surviving German groups had been captured or killed. Over the next week or so, the Red Army claimed to have captured another 15,000 in small groups and killed close to 30,000. Of course, those are Soviet numbers, so we need a few pinches of salt to go along with them. Quoting once more from Anthony Tucker Jones, "The prisoners included 12 generals, 3 corps and 9 divisional commanders, General Lieutenants Vincenz Müller and Paul Volkers, who was also acting as commander of the 4th Army, were among the captured, along with the divisional commanders of the 57th, 60th, 78th, and 260th Divisions." Third phase, Vilnius. Following Minsk, Bagration's focus shifted north to Lithuania and the Baltic. First, at the northern end of what's now Belarus, the town of Polotsk was on the route to Vilnius, now capital of Lithuania. Capturing that city, Polotsk, would also prevent German Army Group North from counterattacking toward Minsk, relieving Army Group Center. Holding Polotsk, the Germans had 2 panzer and 2 infantry divisions south of the Dvina River, while the garrison in the city itself was another 2 divisions. Capturing it was the job of the 1st Baltic Front under Hofan Bagramian. It launched its offensive starting 30th June, pushing the 3rd Panzer Army's 9th Corps back as much as 18 kilometers the first day. By 1st July, the 1st Baltic Front was just 48 kilometers or 30 miles from the city, and the 6th Guards Army launched an attack from the south. By 3rd July, the Red Army was in the southern suburbs. The Germans destroyed the bridge over the Dvina, but the Soviet infantry got across anyway and were in the city by nightfall. On 4th July, the Red Army drove into the city from the east, and they kept going, driving a wedge between Army Groups North and Center. Now, let's shift our attention south again to the cities of Vilnius, now capital of Lithuania, Baranovichi, and Brest-Litovsk, now called Brest. With the losses of the past 2 weeks, especially Minsk, there was no way the Germans could hold the Soviets back. Vilnius was another so-called fortress city, this one held by the 3rd Panzer Army. Rotmistrov's 5th Guards Tank Army surrounded it. Hitler finally allowed forces in Vilnius to escape on 11th July, but few managed to survive the breakout attempt. The 3rd Belorussian Front assaulted the Germans in Vilnius between 5th and 13th July, over a week of blood and fire. 12,500 soldiers in the Polish Home Army, stationed in Vilnius, rose up against the Germans on 7th July. They fought for a week and captured the city center. Then, on the 15th, the 3rd Belorussian Front entered the city. And what happened to those Polish Home Army fighters? The NKVD rounded them up and arrested them, sending them into concentration camps. With Minsk, Bernovichi, Brest, and now Vilnius gone, the game was over for the Germans in Byelorussia. Chernyakhovsky's 3rd Byelorussian Front quickly advanced west to the border, the Niemen River. On the other side, East Prussia, Germany. Now, the Niemen, Narev, Western Bug, and Vistula rivers, as well as the Augustov forests in this area, formed natural defensive barriers. So it wouldn't be easy for the Soviets to get much farther. But I'll go back to Anthony Tucker Jones again. Quote, "The German soil of East Prussia was now under direct threat. While 9th Army was beyond repair, the remains of the 4th Army were instructed to the defense of Prussia. Its remaining divisions were concentrated at Bialystok, and reinforcements were sent from Denmark and Norway." End quote. Anthony Tucker Jones summed it up like this. Quote, "Incredibly, the bulk of Army Group Center had been destroyed in just 12 days and a breach 250 miles or 403 kilometers wide ripped open in the Eastern Front. Between 25 and 28 German divisions were destroyed and 10 generals killed and 21 captured. The near total annihilation of Army Group Center in the space of just under 2 weeks cost Hitler 300,000 dead, 250,000 wounded, and about 120,000 captured. Overall casualties of 670,000. In addition, he lost 2,000 panzers and 57,000 other vehicles. Stalin's losses were 60,000 killed, 110,000 wounded. End quote. And that's where we'll leave it off. There's still plenty of action to come in Byelorussia and in the Baltics and from Ukraine. But we're going to have to tackle that in a future episode. Please come back in 2 weeks for the final episode of Season 3 of Beyond Barbarossa. Angus Wallace, host and producer of the World War II podcast, joins me for a conversation about the Lend-Lease program and what it meant to the USSR over the course of the war. For now, thank you for listening to another episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. Don't forget to hit that follow button. And if you're listening on YouTube, I'd really appreciate it if you'd hit subscribe. If you have a moment, please leave a rating on whichever podcasting platform you listen on. That helps spread the word about Beyond Barbarossa to other people who don't know about it. As usual, I put maps and photos on the webpage for this episode, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. I want to thank all of you who support the podcast through Patreon. Patreon supporters get episodes early, ad-free, and with images. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you want. Do you have something to say, a comment, question, or I know I hate to admit it, but it's possible I made a mistake. So if you have a correction to make, please let me know. Reach out by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca. or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also find me on Blue Sky, Scott the Writer, Threads, and Instagram. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you. Remember, everyone, Canada is a free, independent, sovereign country, not a 51st anything. Original music was composed and recorded, as always, by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, vive le Canada.